Millions of people would love to live longer and have better, more fulfilling lives. And that's why in today's episode, we'll cover the longevity code hidden in your DNA. Len May will tell us how to do this. And he's a polymath, global speaker, recognized authority in personalized medicine, genetics, and human optimization. As CEO and co-founder of EndoDNA, he's pioneering a new era of precision health using genomics and AI to help people understand how their unique biology shapes their wellness, focus, and fulfillment. And over the last 25 years, Len has built and exited multiple multi-million dollar ventures while leading EndoDNA's breakthrough work in genetic wellness and personalized medicine. So, Len, tell us about how your DNA could be the key to better health, focus, and longevity.
Follow me for more interviews with world's most innovative health changemakers to live your healthiest life ever.
Yeah, but thank you so much. And what a long intro I have. I need to make sure that I live up to those expectations of the intro. But, you know, it's interesting because I think people don't understand genetics in general. And if it's helpful, maybe I can give sort of an overview of my interpretation. You know, when we're born, we get 50% of our genetics from our father, 50% from our mother, which we know. And the thing that I want people to understand, maybe 20 to 30%, depending on the individual, are turned on. So if I can give somebody a visual or the audience, think of that as a big circuit breaker box of a bunch of on-off switches. So some of the switches are turned on. Things like our hair color, eye color, skin color, those things are on. The other parts of our genetic predisposition get turned on or off based on lifestyle. And what I mean by that is the food that we consume, nutrients, vitamins, minerals, all the things that we consume, they can actually trigger the epigenetic. And when I say genetic and epigenetic, genetic are your genetic predispositions, that's in your DNA. And the epigenetic is what's been turned on or off, which that information goes from your genome, and the cell is told to make certain proteins, and it turns on that epigenetic expression. So the circuit breaker switches turn on. The second thing is, besides food and what we intake, is exposure to things like heavy metals, pesticides, all these different things. They can affect our epigenetic expression. And the other thing that I think people don't think about is our own neurochemistry. And what I mean by that is things like cortisol that's being secreted into our bloodstream when it's not supposed to be secreted into our bloodstream, that can affect your epigenetic expression. So when you know this about yourself, think about your genome as your GPS of life. This is your GPS, and it tells you. So I live in Los Angeles. I'm from Philadelphia. So I can get in my car and I can drive 3,000 miles from Los Angeles to Philadelphia. Now I'm gonna make some wrong turns. I'm gonna hit some potholes along the way, traffic jams, etc. I'm going to get there, but there's a cost associated with that. Now, if I have my GPS, I can put in my address and it'll show me where those traffic jams, where the roads are closed are. So that's my GPS of life. It shows me where my own potholes are in my own road, where my own traffic jam is, so I can actually take action and prevent some of these genetic predispositions from turning themselves on. So as we're aware of these things and where we're talking about longevity is interesting. I kind of look at it as I had an aunt that passed away. She was 102 years old. But I can tell you that the last 10, 15 years of her life wasn't really living. It was sort of existing. And that's not what we want. We don't want to just live longer. As you said, we want to live a healthier. So health span versus longevity is the focus. So as long as we have the capabilities of living and being able to address any of these diseases that cause aging and are associated with aging, and we're predisposed to these things, we can get ahead of them and make sure that they don't express themselves.
Thank you. Tell us about how you leveraged the DNA information that you know about yourself in order to optimize your lifestyle and your neurological conditions, your mental health, your emotions. How did you manage all of those so that you can optimize your personal longevity?
Yeah, it's definitely a work in progress, but the way that it works is you actually have the way we do this, we have a buccal swab. You swab the inside of your cheek, and then we analyze it in the lab to see what your genetic predispositions are. So, and I'll talk about myself in a minute, but let me just give you a general kind of explanation. So we're doing a clinical trial on Alzheimer's right now. So let's say that somebody has a genetic predisposition to a gene called APOE4. So that genotype, according to literature, is associated with a 50% higher chance of expressing Alzheimer's than the average population. So a lot of people would say, oh, well, there's nothing I can do about that. I guess when I get older, I'm going to experience Alzheimer's. And the answer to that is not necessarily, because if you know this about yourself, you can take specific action. Well, what action can I take? Well, first of all, Alzheimer's is partially caused by beta amyloid plaque. So beta amyloid plaque is the same plaque that's in your arteries that people get in their heart arteries and have to put stents in there to be able to address that beta amyloid plaque. The same plaque is in your brain, and that is associated with Alzheimer's as well. So how do you get this plaque? Well, if you have beta amyloid plaque that's in your heart that causes heart disease, what is that from? That's from eating certain foods. That's from inflammation, food that's creating inflammation, stress, etc. It hardens those arteries, as we say. So if I know this about myself, APOE4, genetic predisposition to Alzheimer's, there's things that I can do by eating different types of foods, making sure that I have a lot of omega-3, some omega-6s. There's a whole protocol that you can follow to see what you can do to effectively mitigate the expression of that genetic predisposition. And that's the process. So you're looking at lifestyle modifiers. So the first one is, what food, what supplements, what minerals, what am I deficient in? What can I subsidize? The next thing is, what lifestyle modifiers can I add? So exercise, what type of exercise? Then you can actually look at, hot and cold, red light therapy, all these different things. And then you can come back and measure your blood work and see what your epigenetic expression is, and then based on the protocol that you just implemented for yourself. So for me, these are the things that I do. So I look at my genome. I'm the guinea pig on myself, on everything. And then based on that, there are certain things that I do. I also added in a gut microbiome. So I realized, looking at my gut microbiome test, that there are certain types of foods that are inflammatory to me, like bell peppers, for instance. When you think about it, bell peppers are pretty healthy. They're a healthy vegetable. They have a lot of vitamins in there. But for me, my gut microbiome creates inflammation if I consume that, bell peppers, for instance. So understanding that about your gut microbiome, you can take probiotics with specific bacteria to change your gut microbiome, or you can just avoid certain types of foods. So looking at the entire holistic self, you can prevent some of these things from expressing themselves. And for me, it's supplementation. It's phytocannabinoids as well. I consume that. It's doing certain exercise. It's going out in nature and the food. Food is probably my biggest change. I don't eat meat. I do eat fish here and there. I don't eat simple carbs. I don't eat sugar. I cut out sugar many years ago, and mostly foods that convert to sugar, because there are certain things that I have in my genetics and certain things in my ancestral genetics that I want to make sure that I mitigate.
Thank you. How can someone reduce inflammation? Is it that every single person has different things that cause inflammation? Or is it that there are some standard things that cause inflammation, and then there are some custom things that cause inflammation for some people, and some people don't get that?
Yeah, all the above. You're absolutely, like, your questioning is fully encompassing. So yeah, there are certain things that cause inflammation. There are certain things in certain individuals that are more inflammatory than others. Like I mentioned, bell peppers are inflammatory to me. It doesn't cause inflammation for everyone, but it does for me. But I think I'll answer the question this way. I'm going to give you a couple examples of how this shows up and the difference between how our healthcare slash sick care model addresses that. And we're accountable for this as patients. So let's say you go to a doctor and you have a pain in your elbow. Now, the doctor can say to you, okay, well, I have a couple options for you. There's an injection I can use, or there's a pill that I can provide you. Each one of them will do a couple different things. So they will alleviate the pain. So me as a patient who is pain averse, that's most of the people in the United States, for instance, I don't want to deal with pain. So I'm going to address my pain. And the doctor, what needs to be successful in addressing the symptom that you just communicated to them. And the second part is do no harm. So if I'm using something that I have a proven methodology of that is going to alleviate the pain, no harm, and you alleviate the pain. So both of you pat each other on the back. The doctor did a good job to address the symptom that you complained about, and you feel better because your pain went away. Now, the question is, what caused the pain to begin with? You didn't hit your elbow. You weren't playing tennis. Something happened that caused the pain. Neither of you went down the rabbit hole of trying to find out what is the root cause, but you had a successful engagement because both of you alleviated the pain that you said you had. Now, in Eastern medicine and functional medicine, a lot of times pain is an indicator that something else is going on. So instead of shutting it down, let's follow and see where it's coming from. I'm going to answer your question about stress and the et cetera. So inflammation, I'll give you an example. Let's say that I am crossing the street and a car pulls out of nowhere and almost hits me. So I'm going to have that fight or flight or flee experience or freeze experience. So I'm going to have a chemical response, neurochemical response. There's going to be some adrenaline. There's going to be some dopamine. There's going to be some converted norepinephrine. There's going to be some cortisol. All that is pumped into my bloodstream. Now, when my brain realizes, you know, I'm safe, there is no lion chasing me in the jungle, there's going to be a reuptake of those neurochemicals, and your brain is going to secrete new neurochemicals to get you back to balance. Now, if you have genetic predispositions that limit the amount of neurochemicals that you're going to express to get you back to balance and homeostasis, that cortisol that you just secreted into your bloodstream is going to stay there longer. And when it stays there longer, your immune system can overreact to that. So when your immune system overreacts to that, it creates inflammation. And that inflammation can be in start in your joints, ankles, knees, hips, neck, back, etc. And if you have genetic predispositions to gut health issues like IBD, IBS, colitis, all these things, it can trigger the expression of those as well. So your cortisol, your stress that you've secreted, that stress hormone that's not supposed to be secreted at that time or is secreted and doesn't reuptake properly, it throws your immune response out of balance, out of homeostasis. So that stress hormone is being addressed by your immune system and creates that inflammation, which domino affects a lot of the other things that you may be predisposed to and creates some of these conditions, you know, that we can go through that are stress-related conditions.
Thank you. Could someone be slim and look healthy whilst actually having a lot of inflammation? Or would you say generally the people that have inflammation tend to look kind of like bloated and unwell?
There's no distinct physical characteristics of specific inflammation. So both can be happening at the same time. There is a lot of people who are thin who are not bloated, who are not overweight, that are filled with inflammation and have an inflammatory response going on, see the inflammation. The inflammation doesn't have to necessarily happen exogenously. So on the outside, a lot of it happens on the inside. Like I know a friend of mine who's suffering from really bad intestinal conditions and colitis, etc. Thin as can be, doesn't be careful about eating what they put in their bodies because as soon as they get inflamed, they have a response from that. So there is no correlation between how you look on the outside and what's going on the inside, with exceptions that, you know, some people have inflammation that it's visible on the outside. You can kind of see that they have that bloating, etc. But for the most part, there's no correlation. A lot of that inflammation is happening on a cellular level or in your joints.
Thank you. What can someone do that is like a simple thing that will lead to a reduction in inflammation whilst, let's say, they don't have the funds to maybe do the kind of specialized tests that you do?
I mean, first of all, one of the most inflammatory things that you can possibly do is eat certain things that are high in refined sugars. So processed foods, sugar itself, that's refined sugar. If you want to do one thing, that's the first thing that I would give up, is anything that's processed that either converts to glucose or anything that is that you're actually consuming refined sugars. That is the first indication of an inflammatory response within your body. This is something that we want to make sure that we limit as much as possible. It doesn't take any money to be able to, you know, limit the amount of refined sugars and processed foods that we put in our bodies.
Thank you. What's your opinion about fruit that is like sweet, you know, that I guess it contains natural sugar? Does it lead to inflammation as well?
Well, fructose is metabolized differently in your body than refined sugar. We have receptors, we have the ability, we have enzymes to metabolize the fruit sugars, that's called fructose, in our bodies and be able to utilize that as fuel, be used by the mitochondria and other things to be able to create ATP for new cell growth. So there's a huge difference between refined sugar and fructose sugar that you get from fruit. Now, when you eat fruit, matters what time of day. So if you're eating it at night, fibers converted, some of the sugars converted to possible fat that's stored in your cells for the time, because your brain may think, hey, we're going into scarcity mode, so now we have to hibernate and keep that for, you know, when we're high, when scarcity and we don't have food available to us. So I wouldn't recommend, I'm not a nutritionist, so I'm going to defer to somebody that's probably more versed than me. But from my own experience and what I've talked to with healthcare practitioners specifically, I wouldn't recommend eating that late at night. And just eating late at night is probably not the best for you anyway. But fructose, really good fruit. You get vitamins, you get minerals, you get everything you need from there. And that's a different type of sugar that actually feeds the cells instead of taking away like refined sugar does.
Thank you. Does inflammation get generally reduced with diet, or is it a series of multiple factors? Like does sleep impact it? Does like sunlight, does walking, exercise, this kind of thing? Or would you say mainly it's diet and there are some other factors that kind of impact it?
I think it's all the above. It's good quality sleep. So we have the circadian rhythm, and when we're at a rhythm, it actually creates inflammation and your neurochemicals are firing in the wrong times. So you're supposed to wake up with cortisol. So when you get that cortisol, the sun in your eyes, you're getting the expression of cortisol. At night, you're getting melatonin. So you're reducing that cortisol expression and you're getting that melatonin that makes you drowsy, makes you sleepy. When you're getting your deep sleep, your theta state of sleep, etc., you are expressing neurochemicals, including hormones. So you're actually creating estradiol and you're creating progesterone, you're creating testosterone. That all that is happening while you're getting good quality sleep. Now, if you're out of balance, out of homeostasis, and you're excreting these neurochemicals at different times, now you're promoting inflammation. So you start going through down the line. Food, to me, it's the most important thing that you can do is put the right things in your body because that's fuel. The second thing is making sure that you move your body. Exercise is different for different people. It depends what type of exercise works for you. As you get older, I'm a big proponent of resistance training because that also helps with hormone excretion, etc. It helps to reduce inflammation, but it all depends on your lifestyle. As long as you move, you know, go. I live in Los Angeles, so I'm able to hike and go out in nature all year round. Exercise is extremely important. And then making sure that one of the things that we forget about is our mental health, because that stress secretes that cortisol at wrong times when it's not supposed to be excreted. And that creates a domino effect for inflammation as well. And if your body's focusing on addressing inflammation that it shouldn't be, it's maybe missing some things on the other side, your immune system, that it needs to actually look at addressing as well. So it's all the above, not just one thing. But if I were going to make a recommendation or a suggestion for somebody to start with food first. You'll get more energy, maybe have that motivation to do some exercise as well, and make sure you get a well-rounded sleep. Look, you know, I was diagnosed with ADHD when I was a kid. So one of the things that makes it really difficult is this reward system, right? So I'm not the person that loves to go to the gym, but I love going to the sauna afterwards. So if you can work out a routine for yourself where you can dangle something, a reward system that gives you more dopamine and anchors you into that activity, you'll want to do it more and more. So for me, going to the gym rewards myself with the sauna afterwards. So I know that I'm going to have to go and do something I don't really love. I love what it makes me feel once I do it, but it's getting there. But if I dangle myself a carrot that says, hey, you're going to give yourself a reward and give yourself that dopamine hit afterwards, that creates a cycle of anchoring.
Thank you. What kind of test is required for someone to know what foods cause inflammation? For example, is an allergies and intolerances test enough to figure this out? For example, I know I'm intolerant to seven things, but I still eat them because if I don't, like there's not much left to eat. So how do you kind of go around that?
Yeah, I mean, it's all individual decisions. I'm not sure if it's a food allergy or intolerant. I like I said, a gut microbiome test, and a gut microbiome test gave me the foods that may be inflammatory to me. Now, can I limit those foods and still eat a well-balanced diet? Absolutely. Is there one specific food that I can, you know, eliminate? Yeah, absolutely. So I went through this Dr. Gundry lectin phase for a while. Now, I don't eat meat and I love legumes and I love nightshades. And now that I removed nightshades and legumes from my diet, I really had nothing to eat. There was a huge limitation of what was available to me. So what I did was I started bringing back in things that I really liked that maybe had limited lectins. So I knew what I was putting in my body. For instance, I avoided dairy. Dairy is inflammatory. I don't need it. I don't enjoy it. It doesn't matter. I can get rid of dairy. But I like eggplant or I like chickpeas. So I started introducing some of that into my diet and eliminating other things I really didn't care for that much. So you have to make a choice what's more important to you based on what you enjoy. You have to actually enjoy your food. You can't just go and eat cardboard every single day, you know, but you have to pick and choose what's more important to you. So gut microbiome is one part of that, but there's a brain gut axis, right? So if you're going through stress and your vagus nerve sends a signal to your gut Your gut is producing neurochemicals like serotonin, etc., and goes back and forth. So now you're creating a stressful environment for yourself outside of the food that you eat, because you have that neurochemistry of stress, maybe by, you know, you're late to work, all these other things. So it's a domino effect as well. And what you want to focus on is when you're producing ghrelin, which has given us that feeling of hunger. Well, sometimes that ghrelin is maybe I'm thirsty instead of hungry. So, and it's producing it while you're stressed. So now people stress eat to be able to quiet that down. So you have to look at holistically the entire body and actually go from what can you do, bring in food that you enjoy, make sure that you may have an inflammatory response, but at some point, you know, you have to balance that out. You can't just eat nothing like I was doing with my lectin diet. So I would just bring in certain foods that are limited, and limit them in quality, in quantity as well.
Thank you. Are all the foods that you know you are allergic or intolerant to, are all of those inflammatory, or just the gut biome test is the that will actually dictate which of those things that you are allergic to are also inflammatory?
Yeah, I know there's different responses when you're allergic. So I'm really sure as far as what allergic truly means, because people express an allergy in different ways. Some of them are rashes, not necessarily inflammation. But I can answer it this way, that a lot of times other things that you express on your skin are an inflammatory response to something that's going on inside your body. So if you're looking for things to be able to limit the expression of what's happening on the outside, limit the response that's going on, you have to look at things that you will focus on internally. So it's about looking at the foods, having a balanced diet, but looking at the foods that may be causing you, like when you eat, are you having bloating? Are you having, these cramping and all these other things? Is that truly an allergy, or is that something that you don't have the gut microbiome bacteria to be able to metabolize that? But also, in addition to that, you may have genetic predispositions to having deficiencies in endogenous minerals. So, I'll give you an example of what I mean by that is. Let's say you have a predisposition, low iron levels, and you decide that you're going to be a vegan, and you're also a female. So, you know, as you're having your period cycle, you're reducing the amount of iron that you have. You're not eating meat. So now you can have an adverse effect by not having enough iron in your diet. Maybe something you need to supplement for. So when you know you have this genetic predisposition, you can actually consume supplements through food or through, you know, additional supplements to be able to bridge the gap that you may be naturally deficient in.
Thank you. Tell us more about the sleep routine. So let's say if I go to bed at 3 a.m. and I wake up at 10, does that mean that my sleep being disturbed? Although let's say I sleep well until 10. And then the fact that I'm sleeping late, does that impact basically my inflammation?
Well, you can measure your sleep quality. So the idea is it's more important. Sleep quality is more important than sleep quality. So if you're wearing a device, wearable device to measure sleep quality, you're looking at your, you know, your sleep cycles. And if you're a night person and you're sleeping, you know, at night, like you said, 3 a.m. till 10, you're still getting your 7 hours, but the 7 hours are really good quality sleep. So meaning your heart rate variability is kind of constant. You're on the rhythm that you're doing it every single night the same exact way. And you're looking at your sleep quality. So you're getting alpha, you're getting beta, you're getting your theta, you're getting your delta, you're getting your quality of sleep, and you're spending enough time in your deep sleep. So you're actually creating that hormonal excretion, then it doesn't matter. What happens is, you know, people that work the night shift, when they go to sleep during the day, that affects, because that sunlight creates cortisol. It's very difficult for them to get really good quality sleep. So measure the quality of sleep that you're getting versus the quantity of sleep, and use wearable devices to be able to track that.
Thank you. Let's say that you know there are certain foods that will trigger inflammation and you eat it anyway. Is there any way to counteract that by taking some sort of supplement, or I don't know, some sort of exercise or something else that will kind of counteract this negative thing that you are kind of like doing to yourself by eating inflammatory foods?
It depends on the food, but there's different things that are anti-inflammatory, natural things that you can consume. There's natural buffers, things like baking soda as well. They can put out some of the inflammation, because some of the foods may be acidic, so they're creating, you know, stomach acids come up. You can buffer that out. There's also things like cannabidiol, CBD. So CBD is a natural anti-inflammatory. It has an affinity for what's called the CB2 receptors. And the CB2 receptors are mostly found in your immune and digestive system. So it'll bind to those receptors and release our own neurochemical, which is called 2-AG. 2-AG modulates the immune response. So it helps to reduce that immune response that creates the inflammation. So by consuming some of those supplements, it'll help to pull in that immune response and reduce the inflammation.
Thank you. I suffer from acne and a recurring sore throat. Is there anything that you've seen other people use that has been effective in kind of reducing inflammation for someone like me?
Well, I always think that what's going on outside is an expression of what's going on the inside. You know, we've had many people who went through, the doctors who had patients that come through using our testing, for instance, that had expressions on their skin of, I used eczema for rosacea, eczema, things of that nature that is being expressed. And what's happening is that something that's going on inside their bodies that you're showing up on the skin. And I would start eliminating certain foods first, starting to be aware, maybe keep a food journal that keeps what foods are you eating, and at that point, what is being expressed in your skin. Then I would look at supplements, and I would start adding in things like peptides, possibly looking at things like exosomes, looking at things like, hot, cold, red light therapy, all those different things. But there's not just one thing. I just, in our experience, it's sort of this model of outside in, inside out. So when we see an inflammatory condition that's being expressed on the skin, the first thing that we would suggest is, like I said, eliminate certain foods, consume certain supplements. CBD is a perfect example of that. But if you're putting it in your body, it's going to go and address the immune response that's happening in your body, but you're also putting it on transdermally. So now it's going through the dermal level of your skin into your bloodstream. So it's doing the outside in, inside type of treatment, which then helps to alleviate the inflammation that's in itself on the skin while it's addressing the root cause of the inflammation that is making that expression.
Thank you. For leaky gut, is there anything that can be done to kind of turn the situation around and create like a healthy gut?
Yeah, I just actually was on a show with this doctor, and her husband woke up the one morning and was blind, couldn't see anything, and went through a bunch of different specialists, and they couldn't figure it out. And they did a scan and said he had MS. So he was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. And as he started continuing the line of, you know, medication, all that stuff, he started doing more and more testing and realized that he had this leaky gut situation happening, and which was causing the expression of MS. So one of the things they completely is they shifted, and they're a vegan. And I'm not saying that this is something that everybody should do. They stopped being vegan. They started introducing organ meats into their diets. And by shifting everything they ate, it actually fixed the expression of the leaky gut that he was having. And he is now at, I think she said, 90% of his vision came back. So he's a very few symptoms, and it all happened because changed everything that they put in their bodies, completely did a 180 on their food.
Thank you. How does someone use the endoDNA process to optimize their own health? Is it that you kind of discover what's your predisposed to, and then you work with a doctor to kind of give you some indications of like, okay, based on your condition and everything, this is like a custom program? Is that how it works?
Yeah. So the doctor would use the endoDNA test and the BIOS platform to first do a genetic test. So they'll swab the inside of their cheek. They'll register. It's HIPAA compliant. They'll send that sample to a lab. They'll do blood work as well. So all the baseline blood markers, we would take all the, and lifestyle, whatever lifestyle intake, we would take all that information, but we build an AI, a large language model called BIOS, that allows the doctor to interrogate the genome and the labs. So ask questions. So show me what, you know, how Lily metabolizes, or show me what was the slope of progesterone. So it'll take all that information and it'll tell you what are the likely impactful markers that I need to be aware of before I make my suggested protocol. And the suggestions for the treatment plan are in three parts. The first is RX, so pharmaceutical intervention. So if the doctor makes a decision, hey, there are some prescription medications that I can prescribe either to address what's happening right now, or maybe it's preventive, I don't know. There's the pharmaceutical part. The second one would be anything that is supplemental. So that can include vitamins, nutrients, minerals. It can also include things like peptides or hormone optimization. So you got to look at your hormone levels as well. And the third is lifestyle modifiers. So lifestyle modifiers are things like exercise, diet, hot heat exposure, cold exposure, red light therapy, etc. So now that the doctor makes those modifications based on the suggestions, they add that into their treatment plan. So now they have their treatment plan. They can upload it to their electronic health record system. And the patient has a patient portal. So the patient also has all that information available to them in their portal. They get their supplements, they get their nutrients, whatever that is. And then they feed back to it through a journaling where they can speak to it or type in it how they're feeling. So it's patient-reported outcome. When the patient comes back, when you come back to the doctor, let's say in 3 months, whatever the doctor decides, and does another blood draw, we can actually measure the epigenetic expression and including the biological age of every single system to see if the protocol, what you're consuming, is effective. If it's effective and it's working, then it'll continue down the line. But then the AI is going to analyze that. It'll make some suggestions to the doctor to tweak the protocol. So it's longitudinal care, preventative care over time that's precise and personalized to the individual.
Thank you. Tell us where people can connect with you.
Yeah, so our website is EndoDNA, E-N-D-O, EndoDNA.com. I'm all social. So Len May, or on Instagram, I think I'm Len May DNA. But I'm accessible on all the social platforms. I also have a podcast. It's called Everything is Personal. You can see it on, there's a YouTube channel or listen to it whenever, wherever you listen to podcasts. And my new book just came out. You can get it on Amazon or wherever you get books. It's called Jack of All Trades, Master of Some. It is the connection between ADHD and polymathy. Sort of, if you don't know what that is, get the book and I think it'll be interesting.
Thank you.
Heal Podcast with Lily Patrascu shares longevity and anti-aging techniques to stay young forever, increase energy, overcome addiction, and live your longest best life ever, shared by world's most innovative alternative and traditional health thought leaders, healers, and doctors. Discover quantum healing strategies to heal your mind, body, and soul.